Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is Sunday, April the 7th, 2024, one day before you know what. Joni Mitchell called the total eclipse of the sun. It's in all the news. Everyone seems obsessed with it. Maps on the BBC showing the path of the total eclipse. And the BBC, as its want, shows where and how to have the best experience tomorrow. 4-minute window into the sun secrets, according to the BBC. The New York Times, as its wont, talks about not just anticipation, but anxiety about the way in which millions of people will tilt their heads skyward on Monday. And one of those people who will indeed tomorrow be tilting their heads skyward is my guest today. And he's not just one person. He spent his life thinking, watching, writing about the moon. Christopher Kokinos is the author of Still as Bright, and has spent his life, as I said, thinking about the moon. So for him, I think tomorrow there will be a special significance. And Christopher is talking to us from Indianapolis. Chris, welcome. Congratulations on the eclipse, although I guess you can't take any credit for it, can you?
I won't take credit for it, but not at least not yet.
So you understand this stuff. Tell us why this is such a big deal.
Well, it is unlike anything that you've experienced. And so I did a piece for Orion Magazine about this because I was talking with some folks who it's like, well, I've seen a partial eclipse. So, you know, I've basically gotten it. And I think that people have seen partial eclipses. They're beautiful, but they're completely different. It's like driving through a field of soybeans and imagining that you've seen the Himalayas. They're qualitatively different experiences. So I've been lucky to have seen one total solar eclipse. There are people, of course, who've dedicated their lives to chasing them, have, you know, the money and the means to do that. But I saw one in 2017, and it took me 2 years to write a poem about it for Scientific American, because the experience was so insanely different from anything that you've experienced before. The light changes dramatically. It doesn't just get dark. There's a strange quality to the light. You see the corona of the sun, which is otherwise invisible, of course, because the surface of the sun is so bright. And the corona is much, ironically, much hotter than the surface of the sun, but we get that glare, of course. And so we don't see it except during totality. It's an experience that's prone to cliche. I don't like to use abstractions like spectacular or sublime too often, but that's exactly what it is.
In their guide to the total solar eclipse, the New Yorker says the eclipses dazzled the ancient world. Now that we understand them better, they may be even more miraculous. What is miraculous in a scientific sense then about this total eclipse?
That's a great question. I think it is actually miraculous. And that was part of what I struggled with, you know, in writing about it, because there is this deep cultural history to how we've reacted across cultures and across time to eclipses. And largely it's been a reaction of fear, right? Of terror, because the sun is disappearing and no one understood why that was. So we appealed to gods, we appealed to rituals, we appealed to, you know, pounding drums to try to get this to change. I should say at the same time also, ancient cultures began to understand that there were cycles to solar eclipses. So they were, in a sense, doing science. They were understanding the mechanisms of the timing, at least, although they didn't understand that it was the moon coming across the face of the sun. So this scientific miracle is that it just happens that the moon, 400 times smaller than the sun, is also 400 times closer to the Earth. And we just happen to be living at a time when the moon does cross the face of the sun it can cover it completely. The other part of this is, if I can do a little illustration, like if you think of this as the plane of the solar system, here's the Earth and, you know, here's the sun, where basically you draw a line through that. Well, the moon is not on that line. It is tilted 5 degrees off what's called the ecliptic. And so if it were actually in line, the same plane as the sun and the Earth, we would have a total solar eclipse every month, which, you know, it would be an, it's sort of an interesting premise for a science fiction writer to imagine what that would be like. So it only happens because of that coincidence in terms of the distance of the moon from the sun and its apparent diameter as seen from the Earth. And, you know, we eclipses happen, total solar eclipses happen, but most of the Earth is water. Most of us isn't populated. And so to have this eclipse happen across the United States, across North America, from Mexico all the way into Canada, that, you know, hundreds of millions of people have the chance to see this if the weather cooperates.
Chris, you, the author, as I said, of Still as Bright, an illuminating history of the moon from antiquity to tomorrow. And you are not necessarily in a pagan sense, but you seem to be a bit of a moon worshiper. You write poems about the moon. Yeah. Is tomorrow's eclipse about the moon or the sun?
That is a great question. I think it's a little bit of both. I think that, of course, most of our attention will be on the corona of the sun and the possibility of seeing there's along the edge of the moon, because the moon is not a smooth sphere. It used, prior to Galileo, it used to be considered by many a smooth sphere, like this divine globe or divine presence. But when we see an eclipse, we'll see these little, they're called Bailey's beads, little sort of like pink fire that's coming across, like little incrustations along the edge of the limb of the moon. And that's because the sunlight's passing through valleys. It's passing through the corrugations of the moon, through the, you know, across the mountaintops. So that's a phenomenon that's directly, you know, sort of as a result of the moon having a terrain, having a landscape. But yeah, our attention will be seeing the sun disappear, having that change in light, the change in the environment around you. Obviously, it gets cooler. It feels like night, but it's not quite night. It's not quite twilight. The stars can come out. There's a possibility of seeing a comet that might be naked eye visible during the eclipse. And this totality lasts 4 minutes, so people might have a chance to try
to find it. What time is it tomorrow?
Here in Indianapolis, it is at 3 o'clock or thereabouts.
3 o'clock in the afternoon, so it'll be lunchtime in the Bay Area.
Yeah, that's correct. Although the path of totality, I think you're in partial eclipse territory, so you won't see totality.
So in terms of this tilting of the heads, Chris, we're all going to do it. We're all going to put our glasses on and do it. But scientists will be doing it too. What is it? What questions are there about the moon and the sun and this eclipse, which are still unknown, which scientists are still scratching their heads on, that we don't know about? Or is everything pretty much known now?
No, it isn't known. And, the science will largely be about the sun, because the moon is going to cover it up. So the moon is the catalyst here. And yet then the science, NASA and other, you know, research institutions and professors from around the world are going to be looking at this. One of the mysteries is the fact that the corona is much hotter than the surface of the sun, and they're investigating why that is. Another thing.
And you've used this term a couple of times. I'm not sure everyone would be familiar with what you mean by corona.
I should have explained. It's Latin for crown. And so when the sun is covered up, you're going to see these, they look like streamers, long lines of fainter light coming off the sun, like, you know, like the fingers of a hand. And that's called the corona, Latin for crown. And those are streamers, you know, millions of miles long of plasma that's been ejected off the surface of the sun. They're much hotter than the surface of the sun. And so what's causing those to get heated up is one scientific mystery, which may sound, you know, arcane, like a lot of science does. But the other part of that that scientists will be looking at is other ejections off the surface of the sun. The sun goes through a cycle of maximal activity and minimum activity. We're in a solar maximum right now, which means it's shooting off a lot of stuff. A lot of that plasma gets blown off in what is called a coronal mass ejection, basically a giant, you know, sort of artillery shot of the sun. And those can come toward the Earth and disrupt satellites, disrupt power grids, disrupt communications. And so understanding how those work and if they can be predicted will be part of the research for this eclipse.
There are millions, probably billions of moons and suns in the universe. Is there anything in a scientific sense special about these, apart from the fact that we're so dependent on them, especially the sun?
Oh, in terms of our sun and our moon in particular?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think I'll start with the moon. For one thing, it's a very weird body to be this close to the Earth. And its formation, the fact that it's so large relative to the Earth is a strange fact that scientists took a long time to try to sort of, you know, get to the bottom of. And it has to do with how the moon formed. For a long time, it was thought that the moon was formed as part of the Earth's spinning. The early Earth's, you know, rotated on its axis much faster. And so there's this really kind of beautiful, I think almost romantic notion actually that came from Charles Darwin's son. And Charles Darwin's son, George Howard, wrote a book called The Tides. And so literally the book on how ocean tides work. And so he thought, you know, the moon was flung out of the Earth. And one popular version of that was that it came from the Pacific, what is now the Pacific Ocean. Well, we know that's not true, although it's a beautiful theory. It was a giant impact that hit the early Earth, blew the moon off, and now we have the moon rotating around us. So it's an unusual moon compared to what we have in the rest of the solar system. And understanding its formation and how it relates to our planet will help us understand those other billions of suns and stars, as you say. And our sun is kind of an average sun, but it's also a little unusual. It's not going to be too big, you know, it's not going to collapse into a black hole, but it's also not a brown dwarf, which is like a Jupiter-sized ball of gas that's not quite a star. So it's in the middle, and in that way, it's unique. But we know now, as you say, there are all these exoplanets, all these systems around our galaxy and other galaxies. And understanding, you know, right here, 250,000 miles away, we have a laboratory to help us understand that.
Is the eclipse, Chris, in an odd way, in almost a surreal way, a sneak preview of what will happen with the sun one day when it will be extinguished, when it will go away? I mean, you get it for four minutes now and then tomorrow, and then it goes back to being what we take for granted as the sun.
Yeah.
But it's inevitable that our sun won't always be a sun, that eventually it will be extinguished. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's beautiful. I love that. And I'm actually obsessed with the idea of the fate of the sun. You know, in a couple billion years, it's going to kind of bloat up. It's going to put on weight, as it were. It's going to expand, become what they call a red giant. It's going to scorch the surface of the planets. The Earth may be incinerated, or it might be pushed out. That push might gently sort of move the Earth out a little bit. But we don't have forever here, and the sun will die, to use a biological term. And that red giant will then collapse and eventually become what's called a white dwarf, and then become a black dwarf. So you're right. It will become this sort of black cinder. And, you know, I'm thinking of, say, the end of, or near the end of The Time Machine, H.G. Wells' classic science fiction novel. He has got this amazing passage about sort of the last dusk on the planet, the last sunset, this reddish, you know, fiery, monstrous sun that's shining down on this desolate beach. So we have indeed imagined in fiction, and now we can project in science what that end will be like. So I think that's I will have that in mind, actually. If the weather cooperates here, I'll be thinking about totality as a preview of, you know, the earth burnt to a cinder, as, you know, some imagined beings might look at the sun as a black dwarf.
Chris, on a more prosaic level in terms of utility, is the Earth dependent on the moon? If the moon got hit by a meteor or self-destructed for some reason or other, would it affect us?
Oh, yes. Yes, it would, very much so. Do you remember the TV show Space 1999? It was a terrible show. It was a terrible show. So the premise of the show was that we were storing nuclear waste on the far side of the moon, I believe, and it's There's this chain reaction.
Oh, I see. And then it,
well, yeah, it blows it out of orbit and just goes badly for everybody. Terrible show, but worth watching if you're sick and you need something to pass the time. But yes, it would be disastrous. When you look at the formation of the Earth Moon system, it comes, you know, at the beginning of the solar system about four and a half billion years ago. This Mars-sized planet hits the Earth, blows the early Earth, blows it all up, and then the Moon, you know, begins to rotate around it much closer. Scientists have talked about the effect of tides. You know, obviously the Moon,
yeah,
both cause tides, but early on, the Moon was just a few thousand miles away. So we had this churning, these churning oceans that were hot, and that probably helped create the conditions for life. So we have the Moon to thank for that, and the tilt of the Earth. So that's really the most crucial thing in your question, I think. We're at this 23 degree tilt. We're not straight up. We're tilted over a little bit, and that's why we have seasons. So if the Moon were to disappear, that tilt would go crazy. So I think it would go very badly for us. And, you know, fortunately, we don't have to worry about that. We've got other issues to think about in terms of the future of the planet.
We'll talk about that. And then so you give more meaning to the word tilt, too. We're all tilting our heads up.
There you go.
And the way in which the Moon tilts at us is the guarantee of the Earth and of life. It's a fascinating subject. Will become particularly fascinating tomorrow in the total eclipse of the sun. We're speaking with Christopher Kokinas, a poet and a scientist, and a man who's dedicated a lot of his creative, intellectual, and scientific life to the sun. Fascinating. We're going to come back, and I want to talk more specifically about the poetry of the Moon with Chris. But when it comes to poetry and meaning, I want to thank our friends at Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for making sense of our world, not the Moon and the sun, but the human world. They do a great job, and they help us bring great guests also, like Christopher Kokinas, going to run a short feature, video feature on Liberties. And then we'll be back with Chris to talk more about the poetry of the Moon and the poetry of the eclipse, which is happening tomorrow. So don't go away, anyone. We'll be back in a second. And tilt your heads away.
News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
We are speaking with Christopher Kokinas, the author of Still as Bright, a wonderful book about the Moon. Liberties is presenting itself as a meteor of intelligent substance. And Chris, for you, the Moon isn't just a meteor of substance, it's a meteor of meaning. You wrote something about the poet's guide to the Moon. What is it about the Moon that for you brings out the poet, brings out the metaphysical thinker?
Well, I think it has much to do with the telescope. We were talking before the show, you and your wife just got a telescope. I've had one for many years. And part of the story of Still as Bright is that I neglected that telescope while I was living in Tucson at the time. City lights drowning out the stars, and I was too overworked, too tired to take the telescope out to the country where, you know, you can see more more dark skies. So that, combined with being a child of Apollo, you know, I remember watching the Apollo 11 landings on television and tape recording on a little cassette recorder. I would tape record the missions and replay them when, you know, in the bedroom of our trailer in Indianapolis. So I had that sort of childhood relationship, and I had a childhood telescope that I gave up. But as a grown up, I've been stargazing for a long time. And then there it was, like, there was the Moon. And I, you know, I was like, why don't I look at that? And I had looked at it before, but I hadn't really looked at it. And by that, I mean having a sense of it as a place. And I love showing the Moon to people through the telescope for the first time, especially children, because there's this just unbelievable reaction. It is an astonishing landscape. That's another world that you can access, borrow a telescope from the public library. Many of them have those. And so you can access as though you're orbiting, almost as though you're walking on the surface of the moon. And so that sublime landscape of the moon connected me to my sense of the sublime living in the American West and my sense of connection to the cosmos, the larger universe that we're part of. So in a sense, the metaphysical for me is very much the physical. I am a hard materialist. The moon is an archive of all kinds of things, science, feeling, religion. It's still an important role, plays an important role in religions around the world. But for me, it is that sort of the scientific sublime and the fact that we're going back there for the first time in more than 50 years is, I think, both beautiful and interesting, but it's also something that we need to be thinking about, because how we comport ourselves on the moon in these coming years will say a lot about the future of our species, I think.
Yeah, so there's the sublime element you've talked about, the moon that brings out the poet in you, and you've written about this, A Poet's Guide to the Moon and Eclipse. But also in an interesting op-ed in the LA Times, you write about the meaning of the moon being more than just metaphysical. It comes back down to Earth and to our relationship with the environment. For people putting the glasses on tomorrow and tilting their head up at the sky, what would you like them to be thinking beyond the metaphysics of the poetry of all this? Do you want them to be thinking about how we're treating the Earth and perhaps the universe?
Well, indeed, I think very much so. And I think that the kind of, how do I want to put this? It's overwhelming. And the totality of solar eclipse, is overwhelming. They're spontaneous. You know, when I saw it in Idaho with just a handful of friends in sort of the wilderness of a mountain valley, there was this just spontaneous, welling of emotion. We were yelling, we were cheering, we were laughing. You know, I was tearing up a little bit. And so that is not trivial. Like that is, it's just not like going to a sporting event. There's something is moving us when we see that. And that sense of being moved by the phenomenon of the natural world is a child's inheritance. Like we have that when we're children, and it gets beaten out of us because we become adults. We have to work in whatever economic system that we're working in, right? And so we have these responsibilities, these obligations, and we don't have our lives sort of crafted to have moments where we can pause and wonder. And so totality is one of those moments, I think, and that's why it's such a big deal. But then it does have this larger implication of, well, if we can stop and look at that, then we can also stop and look at other things, our local environment, our, the park next to your house, or the park that should be next to your house. And, the birds and the trees in the city, as I'm walking, downtown Indianapolis, where I grew up, seeing birds I hadn't seen in Indianapolis before, which was actually, sort of encouraging, a sort of counter narrative to the declension that we, declensionist narrative of the environment that we so often have to tell. So I do think that sense of connection that happens during totality releases that sense of wonder again, and there are implications there and consequences. And maybe part of that message is, what if we craft our lives a little differently? And what if we look at these objects around us, including the moon, and think about them, experience them first, right? Have that experience emotionally, and then think about what the implications are, how we treat them, how we comport ourselves. And the last thing I would say there is there's a difference between a living planet like the Earth and the environmental issues and, questions that we have of, inequality on this planet. There are no indigenous cultures on the moon, but I still hear people talk about colonizing the moon, which makes me want to scream. Let's just not use that word. So how we comport ourselves in these two places has, I think, a lot to tell us about our future, and how we describe those places has a lot to tell us about our ethical sort of perspectives.
Chris, it's interesting you talk about celebrating birds in the trees in Indianapolis. You also wrote a book, Hope is the Thing with Feathers, a personal chronicle of vanished birds. So you have a particular interest in this. it's hard to imagine what other creatures, how they perceive the world. But do you think this eclipse has any impact on other species? Would they be marked by it, or is it only humans who notice these things?
Oh, no, they'll notice them. When we were in Idaho in 2017, we were by the Little Lost River, which is, I love that name, the Little Lost. We were on the Little Lost River Valley Road, and owls started hooting during the eclipse. So they treat it as night. And so you'll hear birds singing as though it's dusk or dawn. And there's some research that shows that some mammals will use this as an opportunity to sneak in a little covert intercourse with somebody else's mate. I don't know. If that's going to happen. I hope not on the rooftop here in Indianapolis. I don't think that's anything any of us would welcome. But yeah, animals absolutely do react to it because it's a signal that night has come.
Yeah, maybe that should be the title of an op-ed or a new book, Chris. Night has come. You mentioned the moon and our moral environmental responsibility in your. Interesting op-ed in the LA Times a couple of years ago. You talk about our responsibility maybe for making the moon green. Lots of stories about the Elon Musks and Jeff Bezoses of the world trying to colonize the universe and the moon. What do you mean by making the moon green? And what should we be trying to do with the moon or not do with the moon? You're also involved in some simulated moon mission. So you take a lot of interest in this. What is it about the greening of the moon that might warm the hearts of American environmentalists?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a big, somewhat complicated question. So let me sort of break it down a little bit from a couple of perspectives. On the one hand, you have a lot of money is going to be spent going back to the moon through the Artemis program, the commercial lunar payload services program, which NASA is sort of renting these private companies who are landing or trying to land on the moon. We finally had a successful one. And the reason we're going back, really the only reason humans are going to go back to the moon, this is not a geopolitical fight as it had been with Apollo and the Soviets. It is because there's water on the moon, which is an astonishing sort of thing to say because it's a very hot place or very cold. And so what over the course of a few years in the 1990s and early 2000s, scientists were able to deduce from a variety of data that there are craters at the both poles, but especially at the lunar south pole, that are in shadow all the time. These are the coldest places in the solar system, colder than Pluto. And water ice has accumulated over billions of years. And so it is an amazing scientific archive. So, you know, we will be able to sample water ice from the beginning of the formation of the solar system, which will tell us a lot, again, to come back to your question about other solar systems, tell us a lot about how these things form. But where there's water, you can drink it, you can breathe it, and you can turn it into rocket fuel. And so there is this movement, Artemis program, the United States-led international coalition. I think there's something like more than 30 nations now who are part of the Artemis Accords, and China wanting to go to the South Pole. This could be the first step to being a multiplanetary species. And so the op-ed that you're referencing was about an experiment that the University of Florida did. Annalisa Paul and Rob Furl, they actually grew plants in moon dust, Apollo vials of moon dust that had been returned. And I think that is an extraordinary and beautiful image. Like here we are growing these tiny little cress seeds. The leaves of these cress plants are like the size of the wings of a gnat, growing in moon dust. I just thought it was deeply moving and poetic. And it does suggest that we can begin to create a human culture on the moon. If we do that, then again, what do we bring with us? Are we bringing our worst impulses? Are we going to treat the quote unquote resources of the moon as resources to exploit? Or as I'd like to think of them, as gifts that we cherish and that we steward, and we take a more responsible you know, sort of approach. I the last thing I'd say about this is I had a conversation with Victor Glover, who's one of the astronauts going back to the moon on Artemis II, which will be a flyby. It won't actually land, right? It's just going to fly by the moon. And he said he and his crew told NASA they wanted to add the word sustainably to their mission statement, to return to the moon sustainably. And he and that crew, I have a lot of admiration for them. And they're thinking hard about these questions of how we sort of comport ourselves. So these are questions that lawyers and policymakers and legislators and engineers are grappling with, because no nation can claim the moon. It's governed by a treaty that says there's no national sovereignty, right? Like, in a sense, Antarctica. On the other hand, that treaty was written during the Cold War and did not anticipate SpaceX or you know, a private company landing private astronauts on the moon. That's not a thing yet, but it could be. So how do we govern that? How do we behave ourselves? How do we describe the moon? How do we convey that back to ourselves? Because description implies ethics. So this is really layered, and all of us have a stake in this. The moon has been a crucial part of human history. And, you know, it's an archive of all these, you know, human sorts of wishes and projections. And any one of us who stops to see a beautiful moonrise has a stake in these questions about the future of that place, because it is a place, and how we behave ourselves or not on the moon.
We have a stake, but we have no right to ownership. Finally, Chris, tomorrow, is it going to be like your birthday and Christmas and Hanukkah and Ramadan all rolled into one? Is this, where are you going to wake up? What are you going to do tomorrow?
Yeah, no, I will be. I've been so focused on working on the book has just come out. You've been so kind to talk about
still
it.
Still as bright.
And so I've been doing
it. It is still as bright. It's a wonderful title for a book. Thank you. Illuminating History of the Moon from Antiquity to Tomorrow. It's a lovely book.
I borrow that title from Lord Byron, so I take no credit for that title, so I thank him. But yeah, I've been working on an article for Esquire. I've been working on all sorts of things with the book. And I told my sister, who lives here in Indianapolis, again, where we grew up, it's like, I only just now today am starting to really anticipate this eclipse. And so I just hope for the people who have not experienced it, who are traveling, you know, hundreds of miles, driving, going to cope with traffic and so forth, that they have a chance to see it, because it is such a surreal and moving experience. And I hope it connects them both to the sun and the moon and gives them a little bit of that sense of wonder that we were talking about earlier.